It's just after 9:30 a.m. on the morning of Thursday, April 26th, and I've just joined a meeting of more than two dozen Kansas City, Missouri police officers, social services, and outreach personnel. Following a rash of burglaries, the department is looking to sweep out homeless camps throughout the city.
That's journalist Paul Thompson. He's recording a ride-along for his paper, The Northeast News, and their podcast. Paul is really moved by what he sees as he walks through these encampments in the historic Northeast, specifically in and around Kessler Park and on either side of the Chestnut Bridge. It turns out, so is the police officer showing him around.
Oh, it's overwhelming. To see that this mass of clutter, debris, trash, all in this one area, and actually realize that people are living down here.
Paul asks the officer, Andrew Bird, for an estimate of how many people live here.
I would imagine anywhere from like 17 to maybe 40 at any given time. Maybe it lived through here. Just looking at the amount of trash and debris and items, some of these items are pretty heavy.
Yeah.
Just to realize they carried them this far here.
And you wonder where they get the stuff too, right?
Absolutely.
So that's the thing. There is a humanitarian social services component to this sweep, but ultimately, the police are looking for stolen items, and that suspicion is not lost on the homeless people Paul talks to. He asks two people what the biggest misconception is about the way they live, and here's what they say.
They say we choose to be this way. That we're thieves. We're crooked. I've not stolen nothing. Everything that I've brought down here has either come off the side of the road or out of a dumpster.
Or given to us.
Salvage in some capacity.
Right. I have not stolen nothing. I do side jobs to get by. I mean,
the scrapyard, scrap metal.
I do a lot of scrapping. I mean, like I said, everything comes out of a dumpster, though. I do not break into nothing. I don't.
You don't want that done to us.
Sure.
You know.
But they are planning on taking advantage of the help that's been offered to them on this sweep.
They're willing to help us. We're in.
So, when the Northeast News shared photos from this sweep on social media, things went bananas. Thousands of people saw the pictures. Hundreds left comments. Some commenters thought the sweep was cruel, intruding on what little shelter and stability these communities had built for themselves. Other people took issue with that, saying, yeah, sure, we have compassion, but these dwellings cause real problems for their neighbors. I'm Gina Kaufman here with the journalist behind it all, Paul Thompson. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So this has turned out to be a wild ride.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting to see just the kind of storm this caused on social media. And some of it was, you know, had some misconceptions, and some of it was kind of right on. And I think the overwhelming response we got right when we posted, the first thing we did was post a video before the podcast. And people saw that and wondered, why are all these police officers going into these people's homes, tearing things apart, getting rid of them, stealing their only belongings? And some of that, I think, was a little bit misconstrued.
What was misconstrued about it?
Well, you know, you heard from the officer there. His name was actually Patrick Bird, and he's a community interaction officer with KCPD. And I think you could hear in that clip just the emotion in his voice. He said he's been to dozens of these camps before, but it's still overwhelming for him, just like it was for me, which is why I wanted to highlight that bit in the podcast that you played. But they didn't take any property away. They didn't pull anybody out of their homes. The individuals that I spoke to were in a tent when we got there, and they stayed in the tent when we left. So all that really came of that was that they offered social services. They looked around the camp to see if any property that had been identified stolen from property or from homes in the area was in that camp, and they couldn't 100% verify that any of it was stolen from homes in the Northeast, but they did offer social services to the individuals that were living in the camp at the time.
What made you decide to go along on this whole sweep of homeless camps through the historic Northeast with the East Patrol? And I should say, the sweep extended beyond that. Homeless camps exist beyond that.
Yep.
But you are a reporter for the historic Northeast through the Northeast News. So
right.
That's why we're talking about this area.
You know, some of this stuff is just a matter of circumstance. I was actually, it would have been East Patrol Captain Ryan Mills reached out and said, is anybody at Northeast News interested in coming along on this operation that I'm planning? And of course, I jumped on that and said, this is an issue in our area. There are people who have had items stolen. There was a rash of burglaries in the area. And I just thought it would be an interesting opportunity, one, to actually spend time with KCPD while they're on an operation like this. Anytime I can get go along for a ride along or be embedded with a unit, I like to jump on that because it offers new perspective into some of the goals and the things that they're trying to accomplish. So I said yes immediately, and it was just sort of a deal of circumstance where I was able to tag along, and they were very open with me throughout the process.
And the word sweep is sort of charged in a way that might be part of what people are reacting to, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And the same thing goes through my head, too. You know, when they say sweep, I'm thinking there will be a ton of action out here today, right? That wasn't really
the
case.
What do you mean by that exactly? What is the sort of scenario that people either fear or find objectionable or maybe even cheer on?
I think, there's this thought that runs through people's head and maybe my own to a lesser extent, because I've been on a couple of these now, that, you know, it's a SWAT team and they've got tactical helmets on and they're running down there with nightsticks and beating people up and, you know, ripping apart tents and sort of terrorizing these homeless encampments. And that's not really what it is. I think they refer to it as a sweep, but it's not as charged for them as it might be for the general public when they see that.
Or when they just imagine what that means.
Right. And in reality, it's, you know, a dozen or a couple dozen police officers along with some social workers that are actually embedded at every patrol division now and also have some outreach personnel. I think there was personnel from Restart there. So it's a lot more compassionate than you might imagine when you see the word sweep. And that said, they were trying to recover stolen property as well. So there were officers there. Some of them were wearing bulletproof vests. They had drones that they were flying over the area. So I think in general, when you hear the word sweep, you think that they've got these, you know, targets and they're going to be charging in there and running through and throwing stuff all over the place. In reality, for most of the day, we just kind of stomped around the woods and talked.
So, but what about this idea of suspicion, like that people who are clearly down on their luck in some way or another, mm-hmm. sort of the idea that you're compounding a bad situation by turning people into suspects by virtue of being homeless? Because that's kind of, I think, that was part of what I understood as the objection in the comments.
Right. Well, it's a difficult situation. The reason why they targeted that area in the first place was because they had recovered some of that stolen property in the trails in Kessler Park. So it wasn't like they didn't have some sort of lead before they went down in there.
Yeah, like breadcrumbs.
Right. They were following something. And to be fair, at the end of the day, they were kind of forthright about the fact that they didn't necessarily find what they were looking for. And that said, they just handled it the best way they could when they went down there. Even when we were sitting in the meeting before we went down to Kessler Park, there was some thoughtful back and forth between Captain Mills and some of the officers that were along for the operation, wondering, hey, what if we come across a tent that's shut? Do you want us to go in there? Do we approach? Do we open it up and see what's in there and start pulling things out?
What was the answer to that?
He said essentially no. Now, if it's open, yeah, we should look to see if any of the items that are on our list are in there. But absolutely, we do not want to be tearing apart anybody's home, even if it isn't sanctioned as you would expect and up to standards.
So can you describe, when you say not sanctioned, not up to standards, can you describe what you did see at these camps? And camps is another word that I understand you were somewhat reluctant to use, too.
Well, yeah, I don't know what is a better word. I mean, here's the thing. The individuals that I spoke with from the video or the audio that you played, they said they had been there through the winter. They'd gone through 6 or 7 tents. And you can see that there is a lot of refuse there. I mean, there's just there's a lot of trash around the camps. There's power tools. There's buckets with a little, you've got a little shower curtain pulled over there so that people have been using them, obviously. There's just piles of stuff. There were some power tools. There were gift cards that hadn't been activated. There were a few tents, but there was a lot of trash. There was just a lot of waste. But, you know, one of the more interesting things, I think the most iconic image from any of that was half of a stop sign or a street sign staked into the ground and then within the gap at the top was an American flag that was waving over the campsite. So
what makes that iconic to you? I mean, that seems like kind of a poignant thing, like a right. street sign in some ways, like I have an address.
Right. Well, and yeah, it's I just think it shows one that there is some level of pride, right? And when people think about the transient population in the city, I think oftentimes people use words like they. But
right.
when
I mean I thought about that myself as I began this conversation.
And it's really us, right? We're all part of the same community, and you kind of feel that when you talk to those individuals, right? I mean, I thought that was very overwhelming. That one, they allowed people who came in with two dozen police officers to kneel down beside them and talk about their circumstances. And two, they were forthright. You know, they said the gentleman I spoke with said a couple of times, hey, we're not crooked. You know, everybody assumes that we are, but we deal with the same concerns too. And also the other thing he said was that he's also scared of some of the individuals that were there. You know, he said the coldest night they had over the winter was when someone came and slashed their tent. And he said he went through 6 or 7 tents throughout that winter. So these are people who are dealing with the same fears that a lot of the public is, but they have that little sense of pride. And they took the time to, Lord knows where they got it, but they got an American flag and they staked it in the campsite. So it gives a sense that there is some more maybe decorum besides just being...
Or an effort toward that at any rate.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And they kind of do what they can with what they have. And I thought that was very interesting. And the other thing is that it's a reminder that, yes, it's not just they, it's us.
Well, that comes to, I mean, one of the debates on your Facebook post was about whether the homeless people living in these so-called camps should be thought of as residents of the historic Northeast, as part of the community.
Mm-hmm.
Because someone had said something about, well, this is really hard for us, for the residents. And someone else said, they are residents. And that triggered a pretty long thread.
Right. There was a lot there. And there's so many opinions. I think I knew in some ways that was going to trigger a lot of reaction, but I had no idea exactly the depth of that. But I don't know if there necessarily is a right answer to that question, right? I mean, they have obviously been living there for months. So in some ways, they are a part of the community, whether you like it or not, right? Whether or not they own a house or are a legal resident, they're there.
Was there anything about this experience, either objectively what you saw or how you felt about it, that was not what you expected?
Sure. I mean, like we talked about earlier, you know, you hear the word sweep and some expectations come in, even for me, who's been on these type of operations before. But to me, what really stood out was sort of the empathy and compassion I saw with the officers who were participating. And I thought that was sort of symbolic of what the police department is trying to do under Chief of Police Rick Smith. He kind of came in, he reinstated the community interaction officers, and several of them were on that operation with us. And the other thing he brought was social workers to every patrol division.
I want to hear more about what those interactions were like between the police officers and the homeless people they encountered, and also between the social workers and the homeless people they encountered.
Well, I saw some of that from a distance. At first, they weren't really wanting me to rush up on them while they were talking to the individuals. So I think those specific conversations will probably have to be kept between the officers and the social workers and the individuals they were speaking with. But I went over there and talked to them after the officers left. And I think the individuals who were living in the camp were sort of touched by the empathetic response that they got from PD. And I've spent a lot of time talking to social workers, too. I got close with Gina English when she was taking over as the first social services coordinator in Kansas City Police Department history. And she's an awesome person. And she is kind of setting the bar for what the social workers are doing now, which is outreach, providing services to families, getting really personally involved with these people's lives before something criminal happens. And I think that's a goal of Chief Smith. And it's one of those things that when you bring social workers into an operation like this, it just is all laid out there to bear.
So when you talked, Paul Thompson, to the guy we heard from earlier, this man who was talking about having been at his camp throughout the winter and mm-hmm. Having gotten everything he had through honest means, he talked about that there was a meeting he might be going to.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me more about that?
Well, they had offered him social services the very next day. Now, I tried to follow up and see if I could get some information regarding that. I'm still waiting on a response, but suffice to say, I'm working on a couple follow-up stories that will hopefully dive into some of these services provided and some of the follow-up from PD, because remember, they didn't find the stolen property they were looking for. So they're looking in other places for that now, and I think one of the things I wanted to follow up on is maybe some of the vacant properties in the area, going into some of the homes that have been set up. So there's going to be a lot more to come here. I'm reaching out and trying to find more information about whether or not they've got services, and maybe someday I'll be able to connect with those individuals again and catch up on them and see where they're at. But right now, I'm not sure exactly what the follow-up on that is.
You know, I've mentioned that you work for the Northeast News, which covers a very specific geographic area in Kansas City and also a specific community of people. Mm-hmm. And I am curious whether this story touched a nerve in part because of changes in the neighborhood overall. I mean, that's a neighborhood that people talk about when they discuss gentrification, all kinds of things like that. And yeah, just the population of the neighborhood is changing. And is this bringing together groups of people who are sort of wrestling for who belongs here?
Well, I think you kind of saw that in the comments, right? There are some people in the area who say that gentrification can't come fast enough. And some say, hold on. We have people in our community that we need to protect when this process plays out. So There is sort of diverse thinking on this one. And as you mentioned, especially if you go to Scary Renaissance, Pendleton Heights, there is this burst of people coming in and rehabbing homes and wanting to, you know, build an artistic community there and bringing families and moving your family down into an area and not just buying it as an investment property, but actually living in the community. So there is this sort of these divergent hopes to, one, protect the families that are already there and make sure that there is affordable housing, which is sort of being addressed by the Paseo Gateway projects and the mixed income housings that are going in there.
Is there a moment from your day spent with the police and social workers in homeless camps in Kansas City that will stand out to you for a long time, that just you think that your mind is never going to let go of?
I think that image of the American flag waving in that camp is going to stick with me for a long time. And the other one is in an area where I was in a separate area, so not where the main camp was, I saw just this very ragtag little hut with the most basic coverage. And there was a stack of wood and a fire that had just extinguished. And I thought, wow, this is somebody's home. They're not here right now. There's no belongings, but somebody lives there. So that stuck with me.
Paul Thompson from the Northeast News, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we are about to talk about new bookstores coming to town. Is this a good time for independent brick-and-mortar bookstores? Some say it is. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're talking about bookstores, like the kind with shelves full of actual books and ink on the pages. Two new bookstores are coming to Kansas City this summer, and another one in Columbia is getting national press because of the author who's opening it and the giant book festival he's already started. This has all got us wondering about the state of the indie bookstore, not just in Kansas City, but nationwide. And we will get to that, but first, let's meet the two women behind one of those new bookstores, Amy Kovitz and Andrea Baca. They are opening the Daily Nada coming to the River Market. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
So start by telling me the story of when and how this whole idea came about.
Well, this was really the brainchild of Amy. We'd been friends for many, many years, and she'd had this dream for many years before I knew her. And, you know, we were both former lawyers, but we weren't super happy in that profession. And she kind of came to me and said, you know, I've wanted to do this forever, and I think we would be a good fit. And at first I thought, this is crazy.
And then tell me more about that thought.
You know, it was just so outside my realm of experience, you know, small business owning. And I'd always loved to read, but, you know, I'd never really thought seriously, well, I should open, you know, I should run a bookstore. But the more thought that I gave it, the more it felt just like the right trajectory for my life. And so that's kind of where the idea started.
Well, Amy, so tell me more about this dream that you had. Why the dream of opening a bookstore?
I think having that dream as an introvert, studious, That's everyone that's like that's kind of dream.
Not that I can relate at all.
Yes. So I always dreamed about it, but I didn't know if I actually thought it was something that I would do. But I thought about it enough to where I was kind of always looking to see, because we're putting a bar in it as well, I would look online to see if there's anything like this. And
you were sort of doing the market research on
always
the down low.
Jotting down notes. And then when Andrea and I started talking about it more, and when I would first talk about it to people, they'd be like, opening a bookstore, oh yeah, that's a great idea.
like with rolling
sarcastically,
eyes. When did you start bringing that up with people? When did you start getting more serious about the idea?
I'm going to say about 5 years ago.
So that seems maybe to a lot of people like a counterintuitive time in the life of the American bookstore to say, I have had a successful career as a lawyer. Everything's going great. But you know what would be a good switcheroo? Starting a bookstore.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that moment 5 years ago in the bookstore world.
Well, I knew it would be a risky venture and not maybe not the smartest business plan, but that's when I started thinking about what are other things that could maybe make a bookstore sustainable. And I would read articles and it would always be like, this bookstore is doing events and we have Rainy Day Books here that does awesome events.
So that was off the table.
Yeah. And then I thought bar, and you would think wine and books go together like peanut butter and jelly. Why aren't there more of these here? And so when I thought about that component and kind of thinking of the alcohol or drink subsidizing the books, I started looking around to see if there was anything like that. At first, there wasn't. But about 4 years ago, there's one that popped up in Denver, Book Bar. I immediately reached out to the woman that started it. We had an email correspondence over like the last 4 years until today. And I watched it, talked with her. I went out to visit last fall. It's doing really well. And then I pitched it to Andrea around the same time, and it was slow. We did a business planning class next door here at UMKC, and then it just started snowballing.
So what makes this a good time to do this in your mind?
Well, Kansas City in particular, I think with all the arts and that are popping up, the Kauffman Center, and we have two great bookstores, but if you go to a city like Paris or New York, there's bookstores all over. And I thought Kansas City could use some more.
And yeah. What's scary about it, though?
I mean, there's always that potential that it just, people will like it, but they won't shop at it enough to keep it going. You know, you can buy books anywhere. Obviously, we've all got Amazon Prime accounts. So really, that's kind of the unknown factor is, will we be enough of a draw to the community that people will want to come and buy their books from us instead of the convenience of online or somewhere else?
Well, we're going to get back to the story of this bookstore, the Daily Nada, which is opening soon in just a bit. But I want to turn to Steve Paul now. Most people in town know Steve from his many years with the Kansas City Star, including a stint with the books section, I believe. But true story, he also used to have a bookstore here in town. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Gina.
So first of all, if you were to step back and tell me a story of the independent brick-and-mortar bookstore in Kansas City since you arrived here in town, what would that story be, like the major ups and downs along the way?
Well, there were some great names of Bennett Snyder was the prominent independent bookstore.
They were in like a lot of strip malls and stuff.
No, Bennett Snyder was a local
wrong.
Independent. You're thinking of maybe B. Dalton or
yes.
Walden Books, those kind of mall chain bookstores, which we in independent bookstore world didn't really appreciate. But no, Bennett Snyder was the great plaza bookstore for many years. Kansas City also had a great tradition of used bookstores. I'm thinking particularly of Glen Books, which was a big downtown operation and then downsized or changed ownership and ended up in a small shop in Brookside, in Crestwood, in its last year. So it seemed to be a great literary town, book-buying town, and my experience here only goes back to, you know, 1970 or so. But over the years, other bookstores have come and gone, including my own.
Yeah, tell me about your book-slinging days in Brookside, right?
In Brookside, yeah. I had spent, at the time, in the 1980s, I had spent about 8 years as the book review editor at the Kansas City Star, and I covered the publishing industry, and I'm a lifelong reader and book person. And like we just heard, I went insane in 1995. And
that's how you would summarize this impulse and acting on it.
A small independent bookshop by the name of The Bookshop at Brookside had been in Brookside for 50 years. It was kind of going down the tube at the moment in 1995. And I decided that because of my experience, I knew how to save it, that, you know, I would come in and anyway, I became majority owner of the
but
shop.
Wait, can I jump in and ask you why did this seem like something important to save? Because I'm guessing that, you know, at that time, I think a lot of neighborhoods did have their little bookshop, and at that time, a lot of them were struggling. Mm-hmm. If I remember 1995 correctly, mm-hmm. and I'm curious.
There weren't that many neighborhood bookstores. Rainy Day Books was around. It had not established quite the foothold that it has in the market today. But there were some used bookstores, but there were very few independent bookstores in the area that sold new books. And The Bookshop at Brookside was one of the last. And essentially, we were the last bookstore in Kansas City, Missouri, that sold new books.
What was important to you about that as a...
Literature lives, and new books are new books, and people who read want new books. You know, stay abreast of the times and be involved in literature, have a community of readers, you know, just all that stuff that bookstores provide. It provides a community. It provides a gathering place. And what they're doing with Our Daily Nada, I think is really exciting. Now, my experience is a cautionary tale to a certain extent.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, I mean, would you do it now? Does now seem like a different moment?
Now and then. The difference is I'm still not independently wealthy. Which would be helpful. The market is extremely different right now and was just about to change. And I'll tell you, when I tell the story of my bookstore, I not only was I insane, but I was not insane enough to quit my day job. So I did this as kind of a part-time activity. But it was 1995. Two things happened. One, in Kansas City, Barnes & Noble opened on the plaza the very same year I started this bookstore venture. The other thing that happened in 1995 was a little online company called Amazon launched. And, you know, that was, yeah, in my mind, the beginning of the end. I mean, its influence was clear even at that time. You know, we were a small bookshop. We had a certain size inventory. We didn't have everything. People came in and knew, hey, we can order, you know, we can get that book in a week and have it here for you. And so people were used to, you know, ordering books and getting them in a few days or a week or so. But as Amazon began to change the market, one, their horrendous discounting policies, and the fact that they'll ship you anything. It's gotten even more critical now with Amazon Prime. You pay for two-day delivery, all that stuff. In a matter of minutes, I think we'll be able to order a book and have it at our house in a couple hours, the way the market seems to be going. But all that dynamics was happening. The cautionary part of the tale is that, you know, in the end, you know, I wasn't very smart. I wasn't rich. We didn't have a very good banking relationship, and I think that was really important to be able to kind of cover our debts as, you know, they accrued. You know, the way the publishing world works, just the dynamics of, you know, the monthly expenses, it's really tough on small operators.
Well, I want to get back to some of the other things you said. Let's bring a national guest in on this. Dan Kolin got started in the publishing industry a little over 30 years ago, and now he's the senior strategy officer for the American Booksellers Association. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. It's been so exciting to listen to your guests. They've covered a lot. I feel almost redundant. Such a fascinating conversation.
The piece of it that Steve was just getting at that I want to mention is the big elephant in the room, Amazon, and then a smaller elephant, but an elephant nonetheless, Barnes & Noble. Those aren't gone. Those are still part of the equation. How do they fit in now? How has that story actually gone in relation to small independent bookstores?
Well, it's important to see, I think, to recognize what your guests so vividly made clear, and that's that, you know, the constant is that everything is changing. When the store opened in 95, it was faced with this nascent threat from Amazon and a kind of established behemoth in the corporate rollout from Barnes & Noble and, at that point, Borders superstores, and an independent channel that was reinventing itself, really. You know, in the 80s, when I first started at ABA, it had been a very good time for independent stores, and some independent stores were actually sort of setting the models of the larger format stores, like Powell's in Portland, mm-hmm. Oregon, or Tattered Cover in Denver. But as your guests have highlighted, you know, the independents had to double down on professional development and get smarter sometimes at business and consistently stay as close as they could to their customers to figure out what it was that they did that was unique. So ultimately the success that we've seen, and it's, I think, important to underscore that the past 5 to 9 years have been very good years for the independent channel, happy to report. And that's because of, you know, untold hundreds of millions of hours of hard work on the behalf of stores everywhere. But, you know, over the past 9 years, ABA, which is the National Trade Association for Independent Stores, has seen sustained membership growth. We've seen a more than a 40% increase in the number of indie bookstore members since 2009. And sales are up as well in the indie channel. Last year, sales increased about 2.5%, a little bit more. And there's been a compound annual growth rate of book sales of more than 5% over the past 5 years.
Why do you think this is? Do you think that it, I mean, is it something in an economic formula, or do you think that it's something like cultural, human? You know what I mean?
I think it's both, truthfully. Certainly something cultural. You know, a huge aspect of this has been the rise and the importance of the localism movement for American shoppers. You know, millions of Americans, and that's like literally millions of Americans, are consciously deciding to take a portion of their discretionary income, if you will, and spend it in locally owned independent businesses like indie bookstores. But it could be an indie bike store, could be an indie hardware store. And what they're finding in independent bookstores is that in a lot of ways, you know, as your guests have made clear, you know, if you know exactly the book you want, Amazon does an amazing job of putting a book in a box and sending it to you. But a lot of times you don't know exactly what you want. You just know you want the next best read for you. And that's not as it's determined by an algorithm, but in an independent store, in a bricks and mortar environment, there's the opportunity for really unparalleled discovery. Mm-hmm. That's one part serendipity, but a lot of parts based on decades sometimes of experience in terms of what's been published. There's more than probably 500,000 new titles published every year. And so going, you know, so being able to turn that noise into a signal, if you will, and being able to understand why certain titles make a lot of sense in Kansas City, but other titles, you know, make more. If you're living in Omaha or you're living in Memphis or you're living in Boston, you know, it could be a whole other set of titles. So when people go into an independent bookstore, I mean, sometimes I say, you know, a book really doesn't fully become alive until it's shared. And it can be an initial sharing between a bookseller and a reader. But as Amy and Andrea were making clear, there's also it's shared in a larger community of people who are also enthused by good writing, ideas. And so people in an independent bookstore can not only have a closer connection with a particular title or a particular author, but also with their neighbors and their community. It's pretty special. As you can tell, I get pretty jazzed, but it's a pretty special place.
Well, you know, I just want to cut to the chase. Do you think this is a good time to open a brick and mortar bookstore?
Well, I do. I really do. And part of the reason is that for many years, there weren't new stores opening because there were fundamental economic challenges, to be sure. That's really has changed. And I think it's because book readers, book buyers, they are looking for that third place. They are looking for a place where they can connect and where there
isn't...
The place
that's not home and not work.
Exactly. The place that's not home, the place that's not work, and the place that isn't the same in... The place that isn't ubiquitous. You know, if you're in Kansas City, and you know, ABA was lucky enough to have our annual educational summit in Kansas City in 2013. So I got to spend some time in Kansas City. And I mean, it's just a remarkable place. People in Kansas City want to go into a bookstore that has its provenance, that has its roots in their community.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman, and in just a minute, we're going to hear what distinguishes successful bookstores from unsuccessful ones in 2018, plus more about that boozy piece of it. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us what brick-and-mortar bookstores mean to you. And Steve Paul, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we are talking about the upswing for indie bookstores in American cities. Even as Barnes & Noble struggles to compete with Amazon, brick-and-mortar stores are actually doing all right, relatively speaking, but they are changing in their business model. And that's the part we haven't really talked about yet, but we're going to now. Our guests are Amy Kovitz and Andrea Baca, opening the Daily Nada in the River Market this summer. Hi again, you two.
Hi.
Hi.
And Dan Colon of the American Booksellers Association. Hi, Dan.
Hey.
You can join the conversation at 816-235-2888 to talk about what brick-and-mortar bookstores have meant to you and what you would maybe like them to mean going forward, specifically in Kansas City. So, Dan, this is the piece we haven't talked about. Are bookstores changing what they do as part of this new period of growth?
In many cases, yes. And I think that reflects the commitment of independent booksellers who are an incredibly entrepreneurial cohort of small business people to be unique and to offer what their customers want as intelligent complements to books, if you will. And increasingly, it can be the very component that Amy and Andrea are going to implement in their new business. There's so much of, you know, books. As soon as you finish, you know, a book that you love, fiction, nonfiction, the almost unmistakable next step is you want to share it with someone. And you know, to share it over wine or, you know, something in that environment just makes total sense. They alluded to Book Bar in Denver. Nicole Sullivan, the owner there, is just a very smart and really creative bookseller who has been, I know it sounds like in the case of Amy and Andrea, generous, and I know from other cases where she's been generous in sharing. And that's something that professionals and colleagues that I've met in other industries point out as being quite unique about the bookstore, the book selling environment. It is a phenomenally collegial constellation of small business people. They really do want to see, you know, the more bookstores, the better. They're very generous. A lot of what ABA does focuses on education, and we couldn't do that without the active participation in ideas and talent and, you know, leading sessions, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I want to jump in and let Amy and Andrea speak to this. I mean, this is kind of what you're doing, the whole bookstore with a bar or bar with a bookstore model, depending on how you look at it. But I guess I'm curious, is the idea kind of that the bar on some level supports the bookstore? Like one is the dream and one is the income generating piece of it?
Yeah, we think of our Daily Nada as primarily a bookstore. That's definitely the dream. But sales are good and there's more bookstores opening, but the margins are still thin. So we have to add that other component to kind of keep the bookstore going.
So it's like the concession stand at the movie theater.
Yes. But it kind of helps create that whole experience that we want to give people, that you can share books with people over a glass of wine. And so it's not just a place to shop. It's a place to really kind of exist for a while.
So getting past the book specific piece of it, I mean, and looking really at the Kansas City piece of it, what is it that, I mean, it seems like this is, as you were saying, part of a moment in Kansas City and specifically in the neighborhood that you're landing in the city market. What do you feel like this bookstore means to that moment?
Well, I think Kansas City it's a special place in that it really supports small business. I moved here from Iowa about 7 years ago, and I was really struck by just the variety of local restaurants, and, you know, it wasn't chain everywhere. And so I think that having a local bookstore in that neighborhood is just, it's such a good, you know, a right fit for Kansas City, because people here like that unique aspect of the city.
And one of the reasons we chose River Market was because of the farmers market. And we thought that this is a neighborhood, it's walkable, and people that would support these local businesses that are here in the farmers market are likely the people that are going to support an independent bookstore. I'm also a partner in another business that opened in the River Market 4 years ago that's done well, that is also kind of a dying breed business, that it's flourishing.
What is that?
A Houndstooth. It's a menswear and tailor shop. And you don't see those around anymore, and it's doing great.
And it's flourishing specifically, you think, having something to do with the city market?
The neighborhood?
Yeah.
Yeah. And just being able to come in and get your clothes tailored by someone who's been in the business for a long time. My husband is a third-generation tailor and clothes seller. They can come in, talk, get their pants tailored while they sit there and wait.
So you're saying, like, the person who wants to get the kale from the farmer who grew it also wants to go to the tailor and have that, like, old-time experience and might also want to come to a bookstore.
I think definitely would want to support a bookstore.
Super interesting. Let's talk to Tony in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Tony.
Good morning, Gina and company.
What would you like to share?
Well, a few years ago, I had the opportunity to work at Spivey's on Westport Road. Rare and used bookstore, and it was a wonderful experience. Seemed like the people there had a deep appreciation for the culture of bookstores, like an artisanal sort of thing.
And what did that experience mean to you, or what does it tell you about what bookstores either add to communities or mean to people who visit them?
Well, it seems like Spivey's in particular, being a rare and used bookstore, hasn't been replicated, so I would like to see something like that return to Kansas City.
So the niche bookstore as, like, I mean, we actually did used to have quite a few niche bookstores. Dan Cullen, what would you say about that? Is that part of what's coming back, or is it really more the books and something else on the side thing?
Well, I think the something else for some bookstores, Gina, can be antiquarian or used. As Amy and Andrea alluded to, you know, there's different margins in there. So there's different ways to try and suss out whether or not the community is looking for that kind of a thing. So a lot of times, though, for a true antiquarian store, there's a real unique skill set and a different kind of online competition challenge as well.
You know, there is, as I mentioned, another bookstore opening in downtown Kansas City also next month. And, you know, I just think about, I go on trips to cities where there can be a whole sort of culture of bookstores. But is that, do you see that as a bad thing, Dan, as far as what the prospects are for each of those individual bookstores? Or do you see that as, no, you're on the right track when you see someone else on it too?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely the latter. Book buyers buy books, and they don't buy books in just one place. So there's a lot of markets in the country where we have a very, you know, a somewhat of a concentration of members. That seems to be an instance where kind of the rising tide does raise more than one boat.
You know, we have Phil from Liberty calling, and we don't have time to take that call, but Phil wants us to address how the issue of ebooks fits into all of this. Can you do that for us, Dan?
Well, you know, curiously, ebook sales have seemed to have, for now, reached their peak. Ebook sales were down in 2017, and over the last, you know, I think it's maybe the last 3 years or so, the compound annual growth rate for print books is about 3%, which is not gangbusters, but solid. And I think that, as was the case with other media, despite the belief in before, you know, in 2008, 2007, that not only would bookstores go away, bricks and mortar bookstores, but that printed books would go away. Contrary to that, as with other media, for the most part, readers are going to be hybrid readers. So it's going to depend on, a lot of times it's going to depend on what the title is and what the context is. There are a lot of people are going to take that e-reader with them when they go on vacation. And when they return, you know, for the other 50 weeks or so of the year, they're probably going to read the majority of their books as print books. So I think that it's going to be a question of both rather than either or for the most part.
So it sounds like the doom and gloom surrounding books and bookstores from recent years has kind of quieted a bit. And this, I know, is good news to people opening a bookstore. And Amy, before we go, I mean, just leave us a little more with what this means to you personally, that you are finally doing it. You're opening your bookstore.
It's a dream come true. I hope people come there and buy books and drink wine and have conversations, and that it's a real community space.
Yeah. You know, Amy and I connected originally over our love for reading, and we want everyone to come in and have that same connection because it's a special one.
Well, our time is up, but Amy and Andrea, good luck to you launching your bookstore next month.
Thank you.
Amy and Andrea are the owners of the Daily Nada, coming to the River Market. And Dan Cullen with us from the American Booksellers Association. Thanks for sharing your insights.
Gina, thanks. It's been a pleasure to be here, and I have another great reason to come to Kansas City.
Yay, thanks. Well, you can grab this morning's conversations online at kcur.org/centralstandard. Earlier today, we talked about a police sweep of homeless camps in the historic Northeast. You can get it at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, a lost ancient city discovered in Kansas about a year ago has changed what we think we know about how indigenous people lived in this part of the country. They're starting to offer limited tours, but the modern city sitting on top of the ancient site makes that tricky. Tune in at 10 tomorrow to hear more. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.